Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rat. Recently, the long list for the Ockham Book Awards for 2026 has been released. It's always hugely entertaining and interesting to see which books have made the list. The fiction list, many of those on, I think we could have anticipated. People like Catherine Chidji, Duncan Sarkis, and Dominic Hui are there, and some other names that are possibly new to you, new to me as well. I'm talking today with Sam Mann, who is well known as a writer and a sculptor and a painter and an activist. But this, his first novel, How to Paint a Nude, is there on the long list. So it'll be good fun talking to Sam. He likes to provoke. And another writer I spoke to last year who's been long listed for the Illustrated Nonfiction Prize is historian Derek Leask. His Atlas of the New Zealand Wars, Volume 1, Early Engagements to the Second Taranaki War, is a monumental work. And very sadly, Derek died recently, so will not be here to, but his family, his whānau will, to celebrate being long listed. I thought it would be a great opportunity to replay the interview I did with him when he came through last year. And the third writer I'm talking to today, another writer who has been writing and working on literature for many years, is Michael Jackson. He is an anthropologist, an academic. He's lived out of New Zealand for many years, but he continues to come back. And he has just published a new collection of short stories called Outliers. I really enjoyed this and have really enjoyed talking with him about this new work. Sam Mann is well known in Otatahi and Te Waipounamu for his artistic endeavours and his activism. He's an accomplished sculptor, painter, writer, and contrarian. He won the E.H. McCormick Award for Best First Book of Nonfiction in 2003 for his book The Year of the Horse, and achieved notoriety for his lifelike sculpture of Nick Smith, then Minister of the Environment, defecating into a very small vessel outside the offices of ECAN in Otatahi. How to Paint a Nude is his first adult book of fiction and continues his foray into controversy in a different genre. So first of all, welcome back, Sam, because we have talked
A long time ago.
Yes. And congratulations.
I was a lot younger then.
I wasn't.
Carry on. Yeah. Congratulations on what?
On being long listed for this year's Ockham Book Awards.
Yeah. It's strange. It's like being in a race. I came third in a race once where there were three people.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of books around at the moment. Do people still read? You'd know, wouldn't you?
I read. People I know read. Yeah. There are a lot of books of fiction that didn't get into that long list.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think you can take some pride in it.
What is it about fiction? Do you think, would you rather read a documentary work or a biography or fiction?
Well, when I was younger, I was almost entirely reading fiction, but as I got older, I started appreciating nonfiction because I think people became better at writing nonfiction enticing, is that the right word? But yeah, they started using nonfiction or using probably fictional ways of writing nonfiction. And then I began to enjoy poetry and memoir. But anyway, this is my interview.
Oh, damn.
Yes. I don't want us to go off course too far, Sam. Your, you know, earlier works have been nonfiction. So clearly there was a choice this time to use fiction to tell this particular story.
Somebody asked me that at the book launch, is why create a fiction out of something that's very real? You
know? Yes.
And it just, I think it creates, when you have a character like this, I found myself having a friend in my head with whom I could exchange my ideas and who would argue back to me. It was like playing chess single-handed. I could just swap chairs. If I asked a question of him, then I'd say, well, how is he going to answer that? And I'd be surprised by the answer that came back, and that would lead to another question. So the thing just started to evolve in front of me, but I had him asking questions that I wasn't asking, I think. So I was learning as I went through it. I didn't know where the book was going to go. And with every chapter, it would lead me in a different direction, which is how I used to paint. When I first started at art school, I'd have a canvas in front of me. I didn't know where I was going to go. It was an adventure. When I got older, I knew exactly where I was going. The adventure went out of it. It's like, I think it was Da Vinci. I was asked to paint a cardinal. And I remember reading the story where he was already mixing up the final varnishes before he started the painting. He knew where he was going and the adventure had gone. I listened to Yo-Yo Ma playing The Swan when he was 20. What a delicate, beautiful piece. When he played it when he was 60, of course, it was clean and it was nice, but it didn't have that scariness in it that he might fall off the high wire. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course.
So that's, I think, having somebody guide me through this thing in all kinds of directions, and I didn't really have control, was a beautiful thing. When I write a memoir, I know exactly what I'm writing about, of course. But this was different, and I'd...
How can you be sure that this fictional character is challenging you properly?
Because I feel uncomfortable.
Okay, yeah. Because somehow, you know, this is where a lot of arguments over who's in control of a character come in, where some writers clearly, you know, in your case, it seems to me you're saying that you didn't have control you were going to be challenged with about.
Yeah, and it's naive of me, maybe because I'm not clever at this. When I first met Barbara Larson, my first publisher, the first thing I said when I sat down with her with The Year of the Horse, that first book, I said, you've got to understand, I don't know what I'm doing. She says, good, keep it that way.
Okay, so this is why you chose fiction to tell to explore this area?
And you can go more broadly. I mean, he can ask questions that I already thought I knew the answers to. And so he was taking me in new directions. Plus, because he was from Belarus, the country where there is no freedom of speech, no freedom of the press and so forth, he had come to this country expecting to be able to paint paintings he couldn't paint in his own country. And by the end of the book, he realizes he is as constrained here as he was at home in Belarus under a dictatorship. Now that, the unfolding of that is to me the pleasure of the story, because when you look around now, even in this interview, there are certain things I cannot say or I'll be crucified tomorrow. I have friends in America who are academics. If they were to sit outside their university with a piece of paper which has the word Gaza on it, they'll be thrown out of their jobs. No, you don't kill somebody today with a bullet. You just take away their funding. That's how it's done in everything. And in this book, one of the things I'm trying to put the spotlight on is it's the same with art. If I was to say the wrong thing as an artist, I won't get funded. I won't be given a grant to continue my work. Luckily, I don't need that, but I have friends in that position. A few years ago, I wrote a poem. A friend of mine put it to music. He had the Mozart Fellowship for 2 years in Dunedin, and he was asked to write some music for a contemporary New Zealand work of art, a poem. He chose mine. It was a rambling 20-verse poem about water, of course. And so there we were at the Auckland Town Hall with thousands of people, and we had the Philharmonic on stage and oh, I can't remember who was this, Stuart Devine, you know, beautiful.
I do remember. Yeah.
He was reciting the poem. I don't know how he remembered 20 verses, but the conductor would conduct the orchestra and then he'd point the baton at Stuart and Stuart would say his line. It was a wonderful thing, right? At halftime, everybody went off. For the real reason they'd come to this exhibition of music was to have the wine and the cheese, of course. And James Wallace.
You can say his name.
Came striding down the aisle, reached out his hand to Chris, to whom he had given odd fellowships or whatever, I can't remember. And he said, Chris, he said, my boy, what a beautiful piece of music, but that poem was utter rubbish. And I'm sitting there cringing and thinking, oh, no, he's found out that I'm actually not good at what I do. He said, Chris, what you need to understand is nutrients in rivers are very good for fish. You should see how fat the eels are at the outlet of my rendering plant. So I Googled James and found he had 7 dairy farms at the time, plus a rendering plant, I think, if I remember correctly, and had been attacked by various environmental organizations. You know. And I'm thinking, well, if I want to paint an environmental piece, if Chris wants to write another environmental work, will he get funding from somebody like James? Now, what the government has done is, because they don't have money for the arts anymore, they give it to the corporates and say, you guys can sponsor the arts now because you guys got lots of money. You know what you're doing. The trouble is that all funding is conditional. It's like Cyrano de Bergerac. Nobody is going to give him money for a poem that criticizes them. And art's job, some would say, is to bite the hand that feeds you. Banksy, who's got works here at the moment, would say that art's job is to comfort the disturbed, but to disturb the comfortable.
It's interesting because throughout this book, obviously, with the conversation between Sambo, the
character,
the character, and Gregor, the Belarusian refugee, there's a banding back and forth of definitions of what art is. And there are, you know, most of them, I think, most of us would agree with, and but is it something that you are constantly interrogating?
Yep.
What is art? What is art? What does it mean? Why have we got it? Who should be doing it? Who should make the choices of what art we see?
Yeah.
Is this an eternal argument?
Sam? I have no idea if it's eternal, but I do think art has a job to do. It's to hold a mirror
universal.
Up to society.
Well, yeah.
Simply this. When I see a square of canvas with paint on it, daubed, splattered, whatever, and it's hung on a wall to cover a crack, that's not art, that's decoration. Art is the crack.
Okay, yeah. That's one of me. They all somehow boil down to that, really, isn't it? That art should make you uncomfortable. They should expose things.
But we don't want that. Yeah. We are.
Well, interesting that this book has made the long list. So, you know, those arbiters of taste and discretion or who should get the funding, they have given your book the tick, even though the book is about exposing the kind of hypocrisy that exist.
I'm rather hoping that the judges are writers themselves.
Oh, yes.
And therefore are artists themselves.
Yes.
And therefore also understand this problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think the final part in this soliloquy at the very end of the book is, he said, we are drifting into a new dark age, but you and I, Sambo, will survive because we have with us those two essential ingredients of civilization, a pencil and a piece of paper.
Yes, well, we hope that even if people get to the stage where they're scratching on a piece of slate because everything has been wiped out, they will still be making images and putting thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, yeah, writing fiction. I mean, clearly you have been afforded, you have inherited whatever, all these different talents.
Yeah.
And so is it difficult sometimes to decide
which one to use?
Which one to use?
No,
to
No, it's simple.
You've got to tell your story.
You've got a quiver of arrows. I think Churchill talked about that. He said if you understand language and you have a master of language, then you have various arrows to choose with which to fire at your target, depending on what the target is. If the only adjective you have is awesome, you're in trouble. Right? So whenever I approach any kind of subject, I think, what do I do? Do I sculpt it? Do I write a piece of music for it, for this particular subject? Mm. Which arrow do I use? And in this case, words, I think, were the best tool.
Yeah. I am on the periphery of the artistic scene here, but I recognize just about everybody in the book. It's fiction, so you know, there are people who you can easily name, like Peter Bevan, Miles Warren, Leslie, who owns the flat, James, who runs Le Café. You can talk about Le Café. And let's say this is on just before the earthquake.
Yep.
So there is a sense that things are coming to a head politically, definitely in the art world. There's lots of lines being drawn. But clearly there are people who are very obvious to me, but you have How did you make that choice?
Because I want them to be generic. Because there are many people who are everywhere. Now, if you saw the film The Square when that came out?
Yes. Right.
Powerful, powerful film. All the people in that film, we can recognize.
Yes.
We know of them because they're in our lives too.
Yeah.
To me, it is a disgusting thing that there is no, to me, powerful artwork on Gaza. I'm going to take part in a sculptural show in March.
Mm.
There will be no works there that will make you cry, none. I have a sculpture at home of a dying Palestinian child, which I've been working on for a year. And every time I see it in my studio, she moves. It's animatronic, so she moves and she breathes and she asks for help. One day I will put that outside the main art gallery when everybody's forgotten about Gaza, to remind them that everybody turned their faces away, including artists.
So do you want it? You want people to be angered by it?
The art should rip away.
Yeah.
The wallpaper and expose the bricks. That's its job, and it's not doing its job. It hasn't done its job for a very long time. And whereas the Pablo Neruda's, the John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath was a fiction, but it wasn't a fiction. Grapes of Wrath is exactly what we are. We feed on each other. We tear each other apart. That's what Grapes of Wrath was. He was telling the people what we are capable of, and what is happening in America right now is right there in Grapes of Wrath.
So you want this book, thinly veiled as it may be, or really transparent, to
make people think,
annoy people,
yeah, of course,
to make them angry, to
someone said to me,
do all the things.
Well, some said to me, this book will annoy people, and I said, I hope so.
Yeah, well, clearly, yeah, clearly. I won't ask what the outcome has been, because that I think we'd be wasting time on that. But I gather you want this conversation to continue, so you're working on a sequel.
Yeah. At the moment, it's not with these particular characters. It's just trained. What I'm doing, I'm placing an artist alongside a theoretical physicist. In my life, I've always had engineers in my life. There's a great line from Thoreau. He said, it's man's nature to dream castles in the air. It is our duty to put scaffolds under them. So with theoretical physicists, they dream ideas. They use mathematicians to bind them and make them whole and make them solid. And so I want to have this a discussion between art and science, between the nature of love and how you actually give love structure. That's one of the... I'd like it just to be a single dialogue right through the book. In Cormac McCarthy's final book, which was Stella Maris, it is just one dialogue, and I love dialogue. In that, it's extraordinary things happen.
Just to finish, you talk a lot in the book about Sambo's art practice, how he approaches drawing and painting, and you use the expression, I'm not an artist, the line a lot, finding the line.
Yeah.
Is that what you have to do when you're writing as
Absolutely. There are moments when I find myself smiling and I can feel a tingle almost because a line falls into place. You subtract one word, you know this, you subtract, put another one, and the balance happens. And I was lucky. My father taught me the skills of language, just osmotically listening to him speaking with his peer group and hearing how language could be used and its strength. And that's why he gave me books like Graham Greene and John le Carré and Somerset Maugham, for the sound and the beauty of language. And if you have that, you can disarm anybody.
Well, disarming. Being disarmed. Yes, it's interesting when you just look at the word itself. Well, thank you, Sam, for disarming us and annoying us and continuing to be an agent provocateur.
And an outlier and a contrarian and all those words, yeah.
All those words.
Which we need. Thank you very much for taking an interest in this and for reading the book.
I always read the book. I couldn't talk to you if I hadn't read the book.
Some people
in
try,
fact, yeah. I've read it twice, Sam, just to make myself look good.
Yeah.
Twice. The book is called How to Paint a Nude. It's by Sam Mann and it's published by Ugly Hill Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
A mighty book, a weighty tome, a taonga and a thing of beauty, the Atlas of the New Zealand Wars is all this. It is, of course, only volume one, and its author spent 30 years researching the book. Derek Leask served in New Zealand's foreign ministry from 1969 to 2012. He was ambassador to the European Union in Brussels, deputy secretary at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Wellington, and New Zealand's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom and ambassador to Ireland. So in the midst of this extremely busy and prestigious job, Derek, you found the time and the interest to research maps. Where did this come from?
Well, thank you, Maureen. Yes, I found that indeed I wanted to do that. It was almost a necessity, I decided, in 1990 or thereabouts, in the context of our sesquicentenary, our 150-year commemoration or celebration of the Treaty of Waitangi. I decided I needed to know more about my own family's parts in New Zealand's early history. And indeed, as a diplomat, I decided that I really needed to understand much better the turbulence of New Zealand's 19th century. So I started researching at that point, found family connections into the wars, and that really led me into the whole business of finding out more about what happened between the 1840s and the 1880s.
So what do maps tell us that written reports don't?
They show clearly, clearly where people went, or at least where they thought they had been, and they allow you to understand more clearly the connection between one place and the next and the difficulties or the impediments that exist in getting there or indeed the dangers of attack or other problems as they moved about the country. Moving about New Zealand was, for the British, a tricky process. They often didn't really know where they were going. And, of course, they had no control or no knowledge of the interior of the country. So at least at the outset, the coast was known territory. The interior was not. And they needed to understand what they were doing.
You make it quite clear from the beginning that these are European, British maps on the whole, that, you know, there weren't actual maps that Māori kept. But there are three instances in this first volume of maps that Māori made.
Yes, that's right. The Māori did not themselves produce great numbers of maps. They knew their way around. And the two or three maps that we have of that were drawn by Māori were actually done mainly at the request of British people with whom they were friendly. And so they were a bit unusual for that reason.
Yes, they would be sketches, really, not meticulously, topographically detailed maps.
But they provided essential essential information, or at least gave an idea about the shape of a defence. There's one, for example, of early one of Ruapekapeka, and it just it gave a sense of the magnitude of the defences at Ruapekapeka.
You have said, I think you've said it, because a lot of people have said some remarkable things about this book, but I think you've said yourself that you've ended up writing a new history of the New Zealand Wars.
Yes. It wasn't plain to me when I started this exercise that I was writing a history at all. In fact, I wasn't even at the outset writing a book at all. I started by just recognising that in British institutions in particular, there were huge numbers of valuable maps that weren't available in any form in New Zealand. And I thought that at least researchers needed to have reliable information about about the holdings of British institutions. And so for many years, I was simply preparing a catalogue of the maps. But then I talked to Sam Elworthy at Auckland University Press, and he was impressed with the catalogue, and he told me, "I think there might be a book lurking in there," and asked if I could write. I said I thought I could. He said, "You better go away and prove it." and so I gave to him a couple of chapters of a possible book. And as we looked at that, we realised that actually if you put the maps together with a clear and comprehensive context, you did come up with a new history of the wars, because the maps, when you associate that with what's now digitally available, all of the old references, if you put all of those things together, you provide a slightly different factual framework for the wars, something which has got more certainty about it, which defines more clearly the paths through the wars and the dates and the people and who was where, and so that you can provide a new history which simply provides more clarity about what actually happened when.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I remember when I was reading Vincent O'Malley's big work, seminal work, I was really interested in how clear it was from the correspondence that he could, I mean, it had been available before, but, you know, the intention of the British when they got here and how they carried out their intention was, to me, irrefutable, really, about what their aim was, what the end of the initiation of a lot of the wars or parts of the wars were, and that seemed to me to be really, really important for us all to understand.
Yes, well, there was a big clash of conflict of objectives in the British system. The one was a sense that Indigenous people needed to be able to live properly and to be treated fairly, and on the other hand, you had the what you might call the colonial imperative, at least of looking after British citizens who were British people who were living in other parts of the world, and those two objectives were entirely inconsistent. Not entirely, but were broadly inconsistent in the New Zealand case.
Yes.
And they wrestled with that throughout.
Yes, because you say, you know, Pākehā leaders are seen from time after time, putting investor and settler interests ahead of Māori property rights.
Yes, and sometimes it was blind, sometimes I think it was deliberate, but that is something which I don't explore in great detail in the book. I do point it out, but my main objective is to tell a clear, easy-to-read story of what happened.
The maps themselves, you say you started off really with the intention of cataloguing them. Did your position, your being a diplomat and your being on the spot overseas, did that get you access to places that other people might have had difficulty getting into?
In the main, no. Most of these are public institutions and they are very good about it, about access on the whole. The problem for New Zealanders in getting access is mainly that it costs you a fortune to get there, and you've then got to have find accommodation, and you're under time pressures, and in the end, many of the institutions are for that reason simply inaccessible. But yes, there were occasions where I think it's fair to say I was treated very nicely because of my position. And that was particularly the case in the French institutions, where I was given wonderful access, for example, to the material in the hydrographic office in Brest in Brittany, and the admiral there was pleased to help the ambassador.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine for a lot of these people who work in these institutions, the archivists, the historians and whoever's there, it must be really, really good to know that somebody wants to see these old documents. It must be a joy to them that somebody has come seeking them out.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that one very good example of that is a wax model that I found in the World Museum in Liverpool, where this is a model of Ruapekapeka, which was made in 1846, probably by one of the crew or the officers of the North Star. And That had a long history. It was held for a time in London, and then ultimately was transferred to the World Museum in Liverpool because their collection was badly depleted by the destruction of the Second World War. So they got it, and now of course it was in their basement. But they were thrilled that I had found a reference to this plan, and then found the plan. And so they took it out, and I don't think they're going to show it, but they're pleased to have some life put back into this piece of wax that was lying in the basement there in Liverpool.
Yes, I can imagine that would be the case. Derek, I don't want to detract from the content of this book, but I think it's worth towards, you know, to end talking about the actual production of the book, because it is the most magnificent book. It's,
yes,
it's a joy to look at. It's been beautifully designed. It just pays great tribute to all the work that you have put into collecting and writing about these maps.
Yes, well, I was thrilled that Auckland University Press wanted to devote some real resources to this. And I think, Warren, that the key decision that was taken by the by AUP was that they were ready to put the money into paying for the production and then the rights to all of these plants held overseas. These things have to be made available to New Zealanders. And they're in all of these institutions offshore, and they were prepared to pay for the digitization of a large number of these plants. And boy, that, those institutions charge.
I bet they do.
Yes. So they just put enormous resources into this book, and it is just so evident in the production of it. It's nice quality.
It's beautiful quality, and even if you're, you know, only remotely interested in the wars, the whole conduct of them, and where they went to, and how they did it, just looking at the maps and seeing the variety of, you know, other illustrations that you've collected. There's, you know, paintings. There's prints. There's, you know, an extraordinary. You know, there's the actual plans of the barracks and the and the houses.
Yes.
You know, everything combines to give you such a remarkable picture of the time and the age.
Yes. And Auckland University Press also agreed with my approach, which was that this could be a book which would be useful to dip into. You can look at the Auckland bit, or the Wellington and the Hutt bit, or the piece about Akaroa, but also they wanted a book which you can actually read from start to finish. Because it's only 175 pages of text, even though it's a big book. And if you read those 175 pages, you can get a pretty good idea of, hey, what happened in these wars?
Yes, you can. And I have to say I'm looking forward to Volume 2 now, because having grown up in the Waikato, I am really interested in following that, you know, very closely.
Yeah, that was my starting point, because my great-great-grandfather provided the little steam vessels which supplied General Cameron up the Waipa River.
And such a that is a tale to be told. Thank you, Derek, for all the huge amount of work and time you have put into cataloguing, researching, writing, and putting Volume 1 together. As I say, I'm really looking forward to Volume 2. So
thank you, Maureen. Yeah, I'm delighted to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is called Atlas of the New Zealand Wars, Volume 1. It's written by Derek Leask and published by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Michael Jackson is an expatriate. He's also a poet and anthropologist. He grew up in Taranaki, I believe. He has lived in many parts of the world, in Sierra Leone, Aboriginal Australia. He's talking to me from the States. His anthropological career has been outstanding, but he is also one of the earliest recipients of the Catherine Mansfield Montan Fellowship. So he has a long history in New Zealand literary life as well. Michael, you were just talking about being jet-lagged and having a foot in your life in America, but a yearning to be back here. It's a perennial state of mind, I guess.
It is, for every expatriate, and certainly for every exile. You can never fully reconcile the place you land up in with the place that you left. And I think it's tangled up, too, with the yearning to be young again, since the place you grew up in was the place where you were young and free and dreaming.
And you were moulded by so many forces back then, parental, school experiences, university, the landscape.
You can't get away from the fact that the first years of your life are the most formative, and I think that's certainly been the case with me.
Now, they're not opposing, they're complementary. Complementary urges to write and continue your academic studies into anthropology. Were they always there? I mean, you know, from the time that you decided to go to university.
Well, even though I grew up in a very happy home and felt content with my lot, there was a yearning early in life to broaden my horizons, to get away from the small town that I felt sometimes stuck in. And so I think that was the genesis of this desire to travel abroad. I never expected to live abroad, as I have much of my life, but then spending long periods of time doing fieldwork in West Africa and Australia and elsewhere in Europe with migrants from mainly from Africa, I've found myself living for long periods of time in a variety of places.
Has your literary work, because you're a poet as well as a short story writer, fiction writer, has that always been grounded in New Zealand, in your experiences here? Yeah.
Yeah, the poetry and the fiction tend to, for some reason I can't fully fathom, always take me back to New Zealand. The anthropology, of course, is always written about other places, since I've never dared do anthropological field work in New Zealand. So this constitutes a bit of a problem, because if I'm going to continue writing poetry and fiction, the New Zealand experiences are quickly exhausted, and I need to refresh them by coming home from time to time, which I do.
Now, there's a lot of questions to be asked about why it is that your fiction, your poetry is centered around those things. I know they're informed by your experiences elsewhere, but does poetry not arise when you're in the middle of Sierra Leone or Australia?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've written a lot about other places I've lived apart from Aotearoa, but I think the deep sentiments are somehow connected to my New Zealand life. I'm struggling to explain exactly how that can be. But the power of a physical place, of landscape, for example, that is so much a part of being a New Zealander, finds expression in the work I've done on Aboriginal Australia, where place is imagined differently, but place is profoundly a part of who you are as a person. And and your connections with your family and significant others. So you can see some kind of continuity between my own sentimental attraction to place and the interest that I've taken, particularly in the Australian work, in Aboriginal feelings about land and the connection between livelihood and living on the land.
Well, let's look at this book, this latest collection of short stories. It's called Outliers, Eight Antipodean Tales. And there's a lot of, you can look at the way you've constructed them and who you've chosen as your narrator and all those sort of technical things that go into these stories. And there's a lovely continuity, really, in the way that you tell these stories. What do you see in that?
Well, I think they're all connected by the mysterious relationship between how we start out in life and what we become in life. I think that we like to tell life stories as if there is a continuous lineal relationship between the early formative years in a family, in a particular place, and the trajectory that follows. But in my view, the analogy with a river is quite helpful, since looking at a river at its source doesn't tell you anything about the course of the river from that point down to the sea, which is full of twists and turns. The water runs into hidden snags, submerged boulders. It floods. Sometimes there's no water in it at all. And so life, I think, is a little like that. You never know quite what conditions you're going to encounter, and you never fully understand, even in retrospect, why you dealt with those, responded to those conditions in the way you did, or what the repercussions of those responses will be later on. So the book's an endeavor to kind of not solve this mystery, but lay it bare by talking about a group of people as their lives unfolded over pretty much a lifetime.
Yes, that's why it's particularly satisfying to read them, I think, is you do follow that trajectory. You do, and, you know, when we read stories like that, we're always coming back to our own lives, and it provokes questions about what your particular life course has been.
Yes, I think it's a little like this phenomenon of going to a school reunion, because you want to compare how your life has panned out with how the lives of your peers or erstwhile schoolmates have panned out. And I think one is always curious about the lives of others, because you were curious about your own life. And in a sense, these stories are remotely concerned with people that I've actually known, though they're not biographical. And there's an implicit comparison between me as I am now and these other lives, partly imagined, which probably haven't worked out as well. The paths haven't been as smooth as mine has been.
Yes, again, that's why we read, isn't it, to put ourselves in other people's positions, but also to constantly be, as I said, questioning our own choices.
I think that's exactly right, and it's also true of anthropology. I mean, I've pursued anthropology because I like to compare the world that I'm familiar with and am a part of with very, very different social milieu and encounters with very, very different people than the ones I would encounter if I had stayed put, if I had never gone as far afield as Africa or Australia or Europe. So comparison is the, as you say, essential to the way we think. We can't think unless we get away from ourselves and make comparison with things that are different from ourselves, other than ourselves. And so we come back to ourselves transformed by these encounters. And sometimes you render an account of the transformation, which we do both as anthropologists and as fiction writers.
Several of the stories, in a number of them, there are tragic deaths in families in particular, and a sense that the characters need to atone somehow, that they may feel in some ways responsible or have had that guilt placed upon them. And that's that's a thread that you've followed in, as I say, quite a number of these stories.
I think that's true. I think that the reflections that we indulge as we go older often do have an element of remorse and regret tinging them. In my own case, I don't have profound regrets. I have a sense of having been extremely fortunate in my life. But in many of my friends' lives, my contemporaries' lives, the regret has been intense. Remorse has been almost a preoccupation of their later lives. And I think I've reflected on that and wondered why that should be so. And why, again, using the analogy of the river, it can't run back uphill. It can't reverse its course. You've got to learn to live with and accept all the things that happen in the course of its movement from mountain to ocean.
So these are stories that you could have only written at this stage of your life and career?
Yes, I don't think I could have ever reflected on the life course without having run it
done
myself.
It yourself. Yes. What, do you feel a sense of satisfaction? I said I did in reading them. Do you feel that after you've written one of these, put all these stories together?
Well, I think any author worth his or her salt will regret one thing, that they didn't do better when they wrote the book they wrote. And I think that every book I write is an attempt to redeem the failures and the
yes.
errors of the previous ones. But that's par for the course. I think that's... again, the analogy is with life itself. We're always kind of looking back and saying, if only I had done that or not done that, things might have been better.
Yes, at least as an author, you get to have, you do get, I mean, you can tell me if you do or not, but you do get to have some control over that.
Yes, you do get a second chance. But it's... The second chance is imagined. It's not real because every book you write is going to be a failure in your eyes. And this is partly compensated for, of course, by other people liking what you've written, even though you may not like it as enthusiastically as they do. But I think what drives a writer, perhaps what drives us through life, is the ambition to improve upon ourselves and improve upon what we do.
Well, I've really enjoyed reading these books. There are a lot of things that resonate with things that have happened in my life, places, situations you've been in. It's a very rich collection of stories. I'm particularly drawn to the cover, which is of an old abandoned farmhouse with a straggly tree and the, you know, magnificent hills, mountains behind it.
Yes, I like the image too. It's a stock photo and my publisher found it and I was very pleased that she did. And I think it is a good image of what some of the stories are about.
Yes, standing alone, but still standing.
And derelict,
after
yes.
After being beaten about. Thank you for your time today, Michael. I've been looking forward to talking to you for quite some time as I've read your work over the years, so I'm really glad that we were able to communicate from America to New Zealand, to Aotearoa.
Great to talk to you too, Mark, and thanks for the conversation today.
The book is called Outliers. It's 8 Antipodean Tales. It's by Michael Jackson and published by Ugly Hill Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.